I'd like to do a bit of an experiment today. And imagine if we are in a court case. You are the jury and I am the offender. Is that the right word? Jury, offender. I'm trying to look at the names. The defendant, am I the defendant? The one to be charged? I grew up on a... I'm just wondering if Phil's got the PowerPoint up yet. I just gave it to him very recently. I grew up on a street full of boys. I had two brothers. And I had no sisters in my family. Next door, there were two brothers. The other side of our house was two brothers as well. And our street name was Boyce Avenue. There were just boys everywhere. And as a result, I didn't know how to talk to girls till I was 35 years old. But we had a big park out the back for all us boys in the neighbourhood to play in. It was about the size of three football fields. So it was just wonderful. And our house backed onto this park and the park backed onto the beach. And you had some really expensive, ritzy houses on the beach, right on the park near the beach, and ours was back a bit. And there was one particular house which was owned by quite an old, wealthy man. And that house used to own the whole lot of the estate. Like, imagine a big farm backing onto the beach, and now they've got all sold off and into various lots, and one of those lots was our house. But this big house was still there with this wealthy man living in it. He owned a brickworks, I think. And he had a house which sort of took over one whole corner of this big park. And he had a house, he had a guest house, he had an office house, he had a pool house, and he had a garage as well, which looked like a house. So there was all these, it was quite a big block of land, 4,000 square metres apparently, with all these different houses on them. And it's quite a wealthy man. He backed onto the park as well. So kicking balls, things, stones, rocks, everything used to end up in his backyard. One afternoon, which is about my experiment, this is the incident we're going to talk about, my friend and I decided to play golf in the park. And the way we'd play golf is to... We didn't have any golf holes, but we'd aim for a tree. So the first person hit the tree, and the least number of strokes. Or we'd aim for a patch of grass, or we'd aim for a swing. There were swings in the park as well. And so we did this when the surf was pretty bad. So we'd go out and play golf in the park one afternoon. And one of the holes we tried to aim for was the rich man's fence, which was his fence bounded onto his pool house. And so it was about 100 metres away. We were trying to hit the fence in the least number of strokes, probably 100, 200, 120 metres away, without hitting the building. And so I did... Oh, I'm not a great golf player. You know when you hit a good shot, you sort of remember it. Well, unfortunately, today was the day I hit a good shot. And I still remember it to this day. You know when you hit a good shot, it makes a certain sound. What sound does it make? Ping. Yeah, just a lovely balanced ping. And I hit this shot, aiming for the fence 100 metres away, just in front of the pool house of this rich man. And it went. 50 metres, it kept rising. 70 metres, it kept rising. And I remember it. It kept going up, and it just hit this plane, and it just kept going. 80, 90, 100 metres. It went over the fence, and it was still going, and suddenly it just came out of the air and just dropped. And it hit the roof, the pool roof, an iron-clad roof of this man's house. And there was an almighty bang. And then guess who was in the pool building at the time? The old man, the rich man. He came out, he raced out, he started yelling at me. I sort of gingerly walked towards where the ball was on the roof. And he got out, started yelling at me, got my parents, my mum and dad, they came out as well. A few words were said and I was sent to my room about my misbehaviour. And the golf ball also cracked a skylight. So how much are skylights worth now? The cracked glass, Dave? $100, $200? That's 500, wow. Mate, let's say $200 back then when I was a teenager. So the cracked skylight, a few hundred dollars worth to fix. Now, you're the jury. Am I guilty of this misdemeanour? Am I the guilty party in this? Did I do something wrong? Yes, I'm hearing a few yeses. Just another bit of data for this incident. It wasn't the first time I hit the roof either. I did it a few times before, maybe with a golf ball, but certainly rocks coming off tennis rackets. This time it broke something. So I should have known better not to aim for the house and this rich man's house. So that's the incident. There's an age-old question, and I'd like it to turn you towards Hebrews. There's an age-old question in the minds of Israelites, and that is this age-old question which God's chosen people often asked, and it's attributed to King David in one of his psalms, and that is, why is God mindful of us? What is man, woman, human beings, the son of man, that you are mindful of them? Why does God care for us? What does God see in us? And you can speculate various things, but the way I fall down on this is that maybe David's wondering about God's greatness, why God is so good, God is just and he's right. And he thinks about himself, and he knows a bit of David's story, guilty, messed up, he got many things wrong. And so David asks the question, why are you mindful of us? And we might ask the same question as well. Why is God mindful of us? We sometimes get found out. We get things wrong. We break skylights. We're judged to be guilty by the congregation. So why is God mindful of us? Us guilty people, sinners who get things wrong. Now this question's found in the Psalms, as I mentioned, but it's the culmination, the answer, is given by the writer of Hebrews in the book of Hebrews. And what I'm finding interesting about this is it not only tells us why God is mindful of us, or why he cares for us, or why he wants to dwell with us, but Hebrews talks about how. How it is, how does it happen that God is mindful of us? I'd like to look at Hebrews 1 and 2. I'd just like to sort of touch on Hebrews 1 because it brings out some context, but focus on Hebrews 2 as we look at the answer here, because this very same question is in Hebrews 2. Why is God mindful of us? And I'd like to continue the experiment and push it to its rightful end. So Hebrews 1, just touching on this. There's a lot in Hebrews 1, but just touching on something I want to bring out. It says in verse 5, in Hebrews 1, for no heavenly messengers, this is the angels, have ever heard God address them with these words of the Psalms. Now, what's interesting about Hebrews 1 is we hear God's word about the Son. God the Father is speaking about and to the Son, Jesus Christ, the carpenter of Nazareth. So God the Father says to his Son, you are my Son, today I become your Father. Or, heard him promise, I will be to you a Father, and you will be my Son. So this is the Father speaking to the Son. Verse 6. Now when the Son, the firstborn of God, was brought into the world, God said, let all my heavenly messengers worship him. So God is talking to the Son and saying, worship the Son. Then in verse 7, concerning them, God said, I make my heavenly messengers like the winds and my servants like flames. So talking about the angels. But, verse 8, to the Son he said, God, your throne is eternal. You will rule your kingdom with a scepter of justice. And then in verse 10, and God continues, in the beginning you, Lord, so speaking about the Son, laid the foundation of the earth and set the skies above us with your own hands. So we have here God the Father speaking to his Son, Jesus, and he says he's to be worshipped. He calls his Son Lord and God. So it makes sense that God is mindful of his Son. mindful of Jesus. But why is God mindful of us? Why is God mindful of us? Why does God care for us? We know the Son is Lord and God. We know the Son is just and right and perfect. But what about us? What about you and me? How can it be that God, one without beginning or end, so much different to us, wants to dwell with us and not only cares for us, but wants to be with us and in us? How can that happen? The answer is in Hebrews 2, which I want to focus on now. This is where Hebrews 2 comes in, because Hebrews 2 is where Jesus, the Son of God, speaks to and about us, human beings, the Son of Man, the small s Son of Man. And it teaches us what God sees in us, it makes us so special. So I'll just read out Hebrews 2. It's quite long, but we'll just pick out a few themes through it. So Hebrews 2 verse 1, it says, "This is why we ought to pay even closer attention to the voice that has been speaking, so that we will never drift away from it." So God has been speaking to the Son. "For if the words of instruction and inspiration brought by heaven's messengers were valid, and if we live in a universe where sin and disobedience receive their just rewards, then how will we escape destruction if we ignore this great salvation? We heard it first from our Lord Jesus and then from those who passed on his teaching. God also testifies to this truth by signs and wonders and miracles and the gift of the Holy Spirit lighting on those he chooses." I'm reading from the Voice translation. Verse 5. "Now clearly God didn't set up the heavenly messengers to bring the final word or to rule over the world that is coming." So talking about the angels. The angels aren't the end all. Verse 6. "I have read something somewhere." This is the question. "I can't help but wonder why you care about mortals or choose to love the Son of Man," which is us, the small s. "Though he was born below the heavenly messengers, you honoured the Son of Man like royalty, crowning him with glory and honour, raising him above the all earthly things and placing everything under his feet." So that's that question. Why is God mindful of us? Why does he place us where we are? "When God placed everything under the Son of Man, he didn't leave out anything. Maybe we don't see all that is happening yet, but what we do see is Jesus, born a little lower than the heavenly messengers, who is now crowned with glory and honour because he willingly suffered and died, and he did that so that through God's grace he might taste death on behalf of everyone. It only makes sense that God, by whom and for whom everything exists, would choose to bring many of us to his side by using suffering to perfect Jesus, the founder of our faith, the pioneer of our salvation. As I will show you, it's important that the one who brings us to God and those who are brought to God become one, since we are all from the one Father. This is why Jesus was not ashamed to call us his family, saying in the words of the psalmist," this is the words of Jesus to us about us, "I will speak your name to my brothers and sisters when I praise you in the midst of the community." And in the words of Isaiah, "I will wait for the Eternal One. And again, look here, I am with the children God has given me." So since we, the children, all our creatures of flesh and blood, Jesus took on flesh and blood so that by dying he could destroy the one who held power over death, the devil, and destroy the fear of death that has always held people captive. Now, I've read this Hebrews too many times, and Hebrews is a remarkable book. It's quite bracing, but it's very difficult to understand. That the logic and the argument moves everywhere. So what I'd like to do is just go through a few different themes of Hebrews 2, and then look at those themes. First theme is disobedience and justice, which is talked about in verse 2. The second theme is penalty and atonement. The third theme, salvation. And the last theme, union. So I'd just like to just pick up a few of these themes in Hebrews 2 and just push our experiment and this incident that I went through to the end. So back to it. So recapping, you were the jury, right? Was I guilty for doing the wrong thing by hitting the ball on the roof? Yeah, it may be an accident, but yes, I'm guilty. Should I be punished for it? Yes, I was grounded for it. Is the broken skylight on the roof of the rich man's pool house my fault? Yes, it's my fault. So what if this old wealthy man came out after I hit his roof and broke his skylight? He came out and said to me, "There, there, Matthew, I know it's probably the third time you've tried to break my house, but it's just an accident. Go ahead and keep playing golf and all will be well." Do you think the old man should say that? Pat me on the head, "There, there, it's going to be okay." No. He could say, "I forgive you," but what's left? What's still undone? Yeah, the skylight's broken. There's a broken skylight. Something has to be done about it. It has to be paid for. My indiscretion has to be fixed. My indiscretion has to be paid for, and justice is required. The punishment of some sort is needed. I have to pay something or fix something up. And this is the first theme of Hebrews, that God is a God of justice when there's disobedience. The NIV in verse 2 says, "Every violation and disobedience receives its just punishment." God is a God of justice. Psalms 89:14 says, "Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne." So righteousness and justice. You can't get away with things. Things have to be paid for, fixed. Psalms 82, verse 1 to 3, or verse 1. "God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment." So we can't get away from the fact that God is just and he works justice in the creation which he created. It's the first theme of Hebrews 2. It starts out with disobedience and justice is needed. So violation and disobedience should receive the just punishment. And this is the condition we all find ourselves in. We just don't have to go break a skylight. We all miss the mark. We all get found out at times and justice should be met. But, you say to me, doesn't it say somewhere in the Bible that God forgives? And you might show me some verses where it says that God covers our sin. So he puts a blanket over it so that we can't see it. Psalms 32, verse 1. It also says that God blots out our transgressions in Isaiah 43, verse 25. So blots it out, no longer sees it. It also says in Psalms 103 that God removes our transgressions as far as the east is from the west. It says elsewhere that he sweeps our wrongs under the carpet, or sweeps it behind his back more correctly, sweeps them away. And the most amazing one is in Hebrews 8:12. I'll just read this out. You can go there if you want. It says, "I will be merciful when they fail. I will erase their sins and wicked ways," breaking skylights, "acts out of my memory as though they had never existed." So God erases our indiscretions, our guilt, as if it never existed. He forgets it. It also says something similar in Isaiah 43. "Even I am the one who blots out your transgressions, and I will remember their sins no more." So, God, does he come up to us and when we do something wrong and say, "There, there, Frank, Freddie, whatever, Susie, there, there, it will be okay, just don't do it again"? Not if we read Hebrews correctly. God just doesn't sort of pat us on the head and say, "There, there, it's going to be okay." God is not like the happy uncle with no consequences in life. Something has to be done about the violations and disobedience and sin. God just doesn't suspend justice. He can't, because he's a just God. The effects of sin need to be paid for. So we're left with this question then. How does God forgive, blot out our wrongs, sort of forget our transgressions, and yet be a just God? How does the effect of sin need to be paid for? and yet free us from these wrongs. This is where we come to verse 6. As I read in verse 6, it says, I can't help but wonder why you care about mortals or choose to love the Son of Man. Back to my golf story. If the wealthy man wanted to forgive me, what would he need to make things right again? As we discussed, he'll have to fix the skylight. He might forgive me and let me go, but the fixed skylight, the broken roof, will have to be paid so it doesn't rain in his swimming pool room. Likewise, God is a God who forgives, but he doesn't suspend justice. He still has to pay for the thing that's broken. The penalty has to be paid. The skylight has to be fixed. I've hurt my neighbour's roof, and my neighbour needs to pay for it, which I think he did in the end. Or what if we've offended God and the wrong needs to be put right? How does this happen? And this is the second thing, penalty and atonement. Verse 9 in Hebrews 2 says, but what do we see? Starting at the top of middle verse 8. When God placed everything under the Son of Man, he didn't leave out anything. Maybe we don't see all that is happening yet, but what we do see is Jesus, born a little lower than the heavenly messengers, who is now crowned with glory and honour because he willingly suffered, paid the penalty, died, and he did that so that through God's grace he might taste death on behalf of everyone. So, there's a penalty, there's a disobedience, and Christ took that penalty for us. Now, you might say, that's not fair. You might say that that's not fair. Is that fair? Is it fair that when I hit the golf ball, broke the skylight, that someone else had to pay for it? Is that fair? No, not really fair. Is it fair then that when we do something, we miss the mark or we stuff up or we get found out, is it fair that Jesus takes the penalty upon himself? God is a God of justice. So how come he gives Jesus the penalty of something that we did? How does that happen? Is that fair? Well, it might not be fair unless we don't first read Hebrews 1. Because Hebrews 1 says that God, the Father, speaks to his Son, who is God and Lord. So what happens is that Jesus, God, takes the penalty of sin upon himself. And this is connects into the third theme of salvation. In verse 10, it says, it only makes sense that God, by whom and for whom everything exists, would choose to bring many of us to his side by using suffering to perfect Jesus, the founder of our faith, the pioneer of our salvation. So, the Father doesn't abuse the Son. The Son is the Word, became flesh. God takes his penalty upon himself. And so we see this, God is a God of justice. Penalties need to be paid, yes. And Christ takes that penalty for us. God takes it on his own shoulders. But there still remains a problem. Now, here's where I'm going to push this experiment a bit further. This is when the experiment... This didn't actually happen, but it's an experiment. Imagine if the wealthy man has fixed my skylight, everything's been done, and a month later, everything's been done and dusted. I've had my time in my room. I've been grounded, told not to hit golf balls in the park anymore. And it's been fixed up. The crack has been fixed. The skylight's been fixed up. Imagine if a month down the track, I was walking home from school and I walked past and looked face to face to the old man whose skylight I broke. What do you think his reaction will be? What still remains in this incident? What still remains? He's forgiven me. He's fixed everything up. What still remains? I'm a naughty boy, aren't I? I've got a history. I've got a criminal record. I've been blighted. I have a reputation, a background. I have a blot on my name. Even though everything's been fixed up, everything's been done, I'm still an offender and I'm still guilty. So he sees me with a bit of suspicion. So, and you've probably heard the saying, if you do the crime, how's it go? If you can't do the time, don't do the crime. Well, okay, the crime was done. I did the time. Things have been fixed up. But there still remains the fact that I am an offender. I have this blot on my name. And this is where the crux of this comes. What God does in order to care for us, he wants to dwell with us and be with us. He blots out our sin. But how does he do that? Because we still have this record. Because he could say, once a sinner, always a sinner. But we see that God removes things from his memory. And this comes into the last theme, the union. And we can see this in verse 11. As I will show you, it's important that the one who brings us to God, Jesus, and those who are brought to God, us, what does it say? Become one. Since we are all from the one Father. This is why Jesus was not ashamed to call us his family. Verse 12, saying in the words of the psalmist, I will speak to your name to my brothers and sisters when I praise you in the midst of the community. Jesus is saying that we are joined to him. We are in union with him. He calls us, you and I, his brothers and sisters. And this is where the crux of this, the wonderful news of the gospel is that God became a human being to be with us, to come down and be with us, so that we may be joined with him. A technical word is the incarnation. God becomes one of us so that when he dies and pays a penalty for sin, we also die and suffer with him. If you're a sinner, if my neighbour sees me, the old man, he sees me as a naughty boy, the only way that can be taken away is if I'm no more. And this is what, in a sense, what the gospel is saying. Jesus is our brother. He's paid the penalty for our sin. When he was condemned, we were condemned. When he died. And death separates us from our wrongs. We're no longer a sinner. We're no longer a naughty boy. We no longer have the broken skylight incident to our name. We've become a new creation. Finishing off in 2 Corinthians 5, we can see what Paul says about this. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 16. It says, because of all that God has done, i.e. that he has come to dwell with us in flesh and take our wrongs, we now have a new perspective, a new way of seeing things, a new way of seeing each other. We no longer see each other as a blot on their name or someone with a criminal record. And God sees us like that. We used to show regard for people based on worldly standards and interests. No longer. We used to think of the anointed as the same way. No longer. Therefore, if anyone is united with the Anointed One, that person is a new creation, a new person, a person without that history, a person for which that history isn't associated with them anymore. The old life is gone, and see, a new life has begun. All of this a gift from our Creator God, who has pursued us and brought us to a restored and healthy relationship with him, through the anointed, Jesus Christ. So this is quite wonderful news. We are seen by God. He cares for us. What does he see in us? He loves us because we are this new creation. We're becoming this new creation. That's what he sees in us, because of the penalty that Christ has taken on his shoulders. So welcome to this new creation which is made in us. It's a reality already. And it's something that we're living into. Not something that we're achieving or we're doing or we're trying to clean ourselves up. It's something that God has done to us and through us in Jesus Christ.